been the pleasure of the National Broadcasting Company to bring you Sammy Kaye's Sunday Serenade, featuring his world-famed swing and sway music. The poem read by Sammy Kaye was When We're Apart by Wilson Derren. Today's broadcast has come to you from our studios in Radio City, New York. This is the National Broadcasting Company.
From the NBC newsroom in New York, President Roosevelt said in a statement today that the Japanese have attacked the Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, from the air. I'll repeat that. President Roosevelt says that the Japanese have attacked Pearl Harbor in Hawaii from the air. This bulletin came to you from the NBC newsroom in New York.
One moment, please.
Hello, NBC. Hello, NBC. This is KGU in Honolulu, Hawaii. I am speaking from the roof of the Advertiser Publishing Company building. We have witnessed this morning a distant view, a brief battle off Pearl Harbor, and a severe bombing of Pearl Harbor by enemy planes, undoubtedly Japanese. The city of Honolulu has also been attacked and considerable damage done. This battle has been going on for nearly 3 hours. One of the bombs dropped within 50 feet of KGU Tower. It is no joke. It is a real war. The public of Honolulu has been advised to keep in their homes and await results from the Army and Navy. There has been fierce fighting going on in the air and on the sea. The heavy shooting seems to be 1, 2, 3, 4. Just a moment, we'll interrupt you. We cannot estimate yet how much damage has been done, but it has been a very severe attack. The Navy and Army appear now to have the air and the sea under control.
In place of the program originally scheduled for this time, from the Donley Studios in California, Mutual presents its analyst of Far Eastern Affairs, John B. Hughes, in a discussion of the latest developments of the Pacific crisis. Mr. Hughes.
Of course, not much yet is known about the Japanese attack on United States possessions today. The only word was from the president in Washington, who announced that there had been an attack by Japanese aircraft on Pearl Harbor, Hawaii. And there was also the announcement of an attack on Manila, on the naval and army base there. Latest reports say that the attack is still proceeding on Hawaii, that the second or perhaps third raid has been made, and military observers are speculating that this attack must be made from airplane carriers, which have come close enough to the Hawaiian Islands to launch medium bombers, which is probably the planes that are making the attack. As for the details, the amount of damage that has been done, very little has been learned. The communications have been in government hands, of course, and there has not been a full and detailed report as yet. About all one can do is to speculate as to the strategy the Japanese have adopted in launching this surprise attack. Whether it was totally a surprise to United States officials or not is a question. Probably the exact time and position of the attack was something of a surprise. However, there is possibility that this strategy may have been suspected because of the change in the attitude in Washington during the past week toward the Japanese situation. The Japanese had asked for more time for negotiation. It was last weekend that they wanted another 2 weeks of negotiation. in an effort, they said, to try to work out a peaceful settlement of the crisis of the Pacific, of the affairs toward peace. The Japanese had maintained the attitude that it was the United States that was being belligerent in encircling Japan, and that Japan wanted peace in the Pacific, wanted peaceful relations with the United States. It becomes obvious now, confirming the opinion of many observers who believed all the time that the Japanese were merely stalling for time until they were better prepared, until they were placed for the attacks that they wanted to make. This strategy was hardly suspected by any observers with whom I've talked, at least. It was thought probable that the Japanese would march through Thailand out of Indochina with attacks across Thailand, probably quickly by air, to the Burma Road, which is supplying China, and which is the vital part in Japan's war in China. Japan finally having decided that the clash with the United States was inevitable, that the attack on the Burma Road would bring war with the United States, evidently adopted this strategy of striking at the United States on the bases farthest from the point where Japan wants to take possession. Singapore, of course, must be a major object of attack in any general widespread warfare in the South Pacific area. Singapore is the vital key to the China Sea, to that South Pacific area. Singapore and Manila and Batavia are the key points. Possession of one or more of these points gives the advantage. Therefore, it's probable that the Japanese will attempt to take either Manila or Singapore as quickly as possible. As for the attack on the Hawaiian Islands this morning, we don't know how heavy it is, how severe it has damaged whatever naval forces were there. We don't know, for that matter, what portion of the United States fleet was in Hawaii at this time. It's considered probable that the Japanese feel that the attack there will tend to keep the United States fleet in that area to meet this attack and to concentrate the interest away from the territory that is more vital to Japan in conquest and aggression in the general warfare of the South Pacific. It's hardly likely that a major part of the Pacific fleet was caught in the Hawaiian Islands. It's believed by some observers, although of course there is no naval information exactly, none has been issued as to the movement of U.S. ships for a long time now. But it's believed by many observers, speculate that for a long time there has not been more than a third, if that much, of the Pacific fleet actually in Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, or in Lahaina Roads, the main quarters for the fleet in that area. We don't know whether there has been any attack on other island possessions of the United States between the Philippines and Hawaii. Guam, there has been no report from there, so far as I've heard. It's been difficult to get information from any of the sources overseas. The communications, as I said before, have been in the hands of the government. It's been difficult to establish contact for information, especially on Sunday, with facilities perhaps not being prepared for this overload that has come about. Here on the West Coast, there has hardly had time for a great deal of reaction from the people. The naval headquarters have canceled all leaves, have ordered all naval men to report to their posts in the base operations at San Pedro and at San Diego. Here is another report which has just been received, which says that at least two Japanese bombers, their wings bearing the insignia of the rising sun, appeared over Honolulu at about 7:35 this morning, Honolulu time, and dropped bombs. A naval engagement is in progress off Honolulu, with at least one black enemy aircraft carrier in action against Pearl Harbor defenses. This is the most detailed information thus far received from Honolulu, giving us information of when the attack began and the number of planes. That's a little bit vague as yet. At least two Japanese bombers bombed Honolulu. The sound of cannonading coming from the direction of Pearl Harbor has been continuing for an hour and a half, according to this latest report, which was received here only a few minutes ago. So far, there are no reports of casualties. No bombs have fallen in the city of Honolulu itself, so far as could be determined by the reporter who made this call, this report by telephone. There's much commotion going on, with planes in the air and anti-aircraft firing. The citizens of Honolulu have been cleared from the streets by military and naval units, assisted by civilian volunteers, all carrying arms. A lot of the citizens have left the city for the hills to watch the planes and anti-aircraft and get a general view of the excitement. One man said, as he passed the reporter who made this report, "I'll bet the mainland papers are going to exaggerate this." Well, of course, it's difficult to tell what there'll be for exaggeration before the day is over. There is an expectation here on the Pacific coast that there may be difficulty here of one sort or another. There has been a great deal of investigation by federal officials lately of plans for sabotage along the coast and military establishments, various points where sabotage preparations are said to have been made. Here's another report by the news wires. The White House announced at 3:22 this afternoon, Eastern Time, that an army transport carrying lumber rather than troops had been torpedoed 1,300 miles west of San Francisco. This placed Japanese naval action well east of Hawaii toward the mainland. 1,300 miles would be just about halfway between San Francisco and Honolulu. This report, again, was that an army transport carrying lumber was torpedoed 1,300 miles west of San Francisco. This was an official announcement by the White House this afternoon, just half an hour ago. If there is naval action this side of Hawaii, it's quite possible that there might be an attack on the west coast. There's been no report here of any activity or any particular fear of attack, but it, of course, always is a possibility. And it must be assumed that the Navy and the Army will man all coast defenses. The offshore patrol ships are on duty. The Pacific coast is well guarded by the, or rather what's called the inshore patrol. That's the what has replaced the Coast Guard, really. It's the Naval Reserve Forces who have manned reconditioned, reconverted boats, former fishing boats, former private yachts, pleasure craft. There are many of them. I don't know how many hundreds along the Pacific coast. That, of course, is naval information. But they are on constant patrol duty up to 60 miles offshore. They will, of course, be on the alert. I presume that those have all been ordered into action. And as I said a little while ago, all naval forces have been ordered to report to their stations here at the bases on the west coast. What the strategy following this attack on Hawaii and Manila will be, whether the Japanese will launch their land attack through Thailand now, or whether the forces that have been concentrated in that area will back up air and naval attacks against British posts, Singapore, for instance, is, of course, difficult to tell. We've had no reports of any activity as yet of these troops in South Indochina, where they have been concentrated. With the concentration of forces there and the certainty apparent that Japan was preparing for action, for military action, without any further delay, that has led to the United States government almost insisting that this controversy, that the negotiations or conversations between the two governments be brought to a climax. Japan, of course, ignored, did not answer the first statement of conditions which Secretary Hull laid down in the document that was handed 11 days ago to the Japanese envoys for submission to their government. The terms by which the United States would be willing to re-enter trade with Japan and consider peaceful conditions in the Pacific. Then came the question, the direct question asked the Japanese government by Mr. Roosevelt through Undersecretary Wells, why the concentration of troops in Indochina and what was the intention regarding these troops for the future. Japan, of course, made an evasive answer to that after a few days, saying that it was the concentration of troops in Indochina was because fear of Chinese invasion of Indochina, and according to the terms of agreement with the Vichy government of France, Japan was protecting Indochina against that feared attack from the Chinese. That, of course, was not a satisfactory answer so far as our government was concerned, because it was perfectly obvious that the Chinese had no purpose for attacking Indochina unless it were a defensive move in that area. Throughout the conversations that have taken place between the United States and Japan for the past several months, Japan has continued to increase her military establishment in the South Pacific area. Not only the concentration of troops in Indochina, but huge numbers of troops on Hainan Island, immediately adjacent to Indochina. And then, of course, this last week, there was not only further shipment of troops, landing of transports, convoys in Indochina, but the establishment of the continuing of naval establishments there in the concentrating naval forces at Cameron Bay, where shore preparations have been made to base the Japanese fleet. Those, of course, are not complete. It's not a thoroughly and well-equipped naval base yet, but in the time since June, when the Japanese went into southern Indochina, they worked furiously, feverishly, to establish that naval base so that it could be used for further operations in that area. All of this information meant one thing to our government. That was that Japan was not sincere in her conversations asking for peace. She was intending further aggressive action in that South Pacific area. And so this week, as that continued, and as the word came yesterday of convoyed transports sailing around the south of Indochina and up into the Gulf of Siam, Mr. President Roosevelt sent a message direct to the Emperor of Japan, knowing that there was no opportunity for that to have any effect, because with the military men in complete charge in Japan, the Emperor has no more power than the lowliest of his subjects. Thus, the Pacific crisis has come to its climax with the attack by Japanese by air on Hawaii and the Philippines. It is quite probable that Congress tomorrow will consider the declaration of war. There seems now no other step. What further action there will be during the day, we will report to you by the Mutual Network from our listening posts here on the West, with a keen watch being kept and every effort being made to establish contact across the Pacific and to get all information available. We'll report to you from time to time during the day.
From the Donley Studios in California, Mutual has presented its analyst of Far Eastern Affairs, John B. Hughes, in a discussion of the latest developments of the Pacific crisis. Stay tuned to your Mutual station for further special broadcasts from the Pacific Coast.
Well, I don't know, ladies and gentlemen, whether you can hear us or not, but we will tell you again that we have just gotten over Manila's first air raid, the first air raid in its history, and from the Japanese point of view, it was a splendid night for an air raid. There are millions of stars shining. They selected their time carefully because the moon, a very bright half moon, is directly above us at the present time, which means that so far as the Japanese bombers coming in are concerned, the visibility was practically zero so far as land defenses were concerned. They selected their time and their position carefully, and it is a very bright moonlight night. Manila is in a state of total blackout. Blackout so far as is humanly possible, but the stars and the moon make it very impossible for us to have a complete blackout here.
Yes?
I shall continue.
All right.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're waiting for Bert Island to get a vantage point there. We'll tell you a little more about Manila. The Pasig River, on which we are standing at the present time, bisects Manila. On one side is the business district, or the Escolta. We hear anti-aircraft fire again, ladies and gentlemen, so it seems that they're coming back again. We'll let you know more about it in just a few moments. It's a little too early to tell just where that anti-aircraft fire is coming from at the present time. You see, we are more or less ringed by armed defenses. Hello, Don. Standing at the present time is...
Hello, Don. The elevator boy ran out on us, and I had to climb up 8 flights of fire escape, so I'm a little bit out of breath. But in the meantime, some of the rest of the staff here have checked up, and we definitely concluded that the fire is now out at Nichols Field. That's the big airfield right in the heart of Manila, in the south part of Manila. We do not know exactly what is burning, but from what we can see from the top of this building, the whole southern skies are a brilliant red. A little while ago, I told you that we witnessed the anti-aircraft fire, which was brilliant tracer bullets going up after those Japanese bombers. And now, folks, I tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to let you speak to them. Rather, I'm going to let one of KZRH's staff members who is up here with me speak to you. Ted Wallace, talk to them for a little while.
Thank you, Bert.
Hello, everybody. Up here on top of the Hecot building, we can see very well. It's a vantage spot. We can completely cover the entire Manila area, looking over to one side, Cavite, out to the other side, Nichols Field, Fort William McKinley, out to the other side, the foothills which surround Manila, also military posts and objectives out that way, and over on the other side, even still more so, pointing up towards Clark Field and Pampanga. Here we are, surrounded by these objectives and raids going on. The all-clear did sound a little while ago, but still, even though it has, you can still see the embers blazing and dying away. The fire, I should say, at Camp Nichols. Nichols Field, I don't believe, has any oil storage or gasoline storage dumps to amount to a great deal. But they do have a lot of hangars and warehouses and things out there where they store their airplane spare parts and assembly and so forth. And it must be those hangars and those storage facilities which we've just seen bombed before our very eyes and burning. That's about all that I know about it, Bert. I'm getting my breath back a little bit. I might say that right now the moon is shining absolutely full. It's just like day. From up here where we are, the galvanized iron roofs, painted, most of them painted with chrome paint, stand out like mirrors. And there's no wonder that an enemy bomber would pick out any spot around this part of Manila tonight. It isn't the fault of the blackout. There isn't a light shining any place. But old man Moon just wouldn't stay blacked out. Although, from reports of bombings earlier this morning, it appears that the Japanese have got their objectives mighty well spotted. They have not hit a single non-military objective or a piece of civilian property so far. The result of the bombing here in Manila just now, as far as we know, was confined to Nichols Field, or Cap Nichols, as we call it out here.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. The startling news of the Japanese attack on American naval bases in Pearl Harbor earlier today and the virtual state of undeclared war by Japan on this hemisphere has, as you may imagine, electrified official Washington and brought about a situation unparalleled in the nation's history. From WOL in the nation's capital city, Mutual brings you a special broadcast. You will first hear a factual report on events from Frank Blair, WOL's special news reporter. This will be followed by a summary of the reactions in diplomatic and State Department circles as presented by Richard Eaton, distinguished analyst and noted authority on foreign affairs. First, Frank Blair.
We're getting right down to the news, ladies and gentlemen. We've been so busy here at WOL and in Washington since about 1 o'clock this afternoon. I'm going to attempt to give you now a chronological report on what has happened in Washington. At 1 o'clock this afternoon, Washington time, the Japanese ambassador, Mr. Nomura, asked for an appointment for the Japanese representatives, Nomura and Kurusu, to see the Secretary of State, Mr. Cordell Hull. The appointment was made for 1:45 o'clock this afternoon. The Japanese representatives arrived at the office of the Secretary of State at 2:05, 20 minutes late. Mr. Hull received the Japanese representatives at 2:20, 15 minutes after their arrival at the State Department. The Japanese ambassador handed to the Secretary of State what was understood to be a reply to the document handed to him by the Secretary of State on November 26th. If you'll remember, Mr. Hull handed to the two gentlemen from Japan the President's proposal for settlement of this dispute between Japan and America and the United States. And that proposal, in effect, said something like this. The President had information that the Japanese troops are concentrating heavily in French Indochina. He told them that this had to stop, that Japan was to break her alliance with the Axis, and that she was to withdraw from China. It was merely a restatement of what the American position has been all along, but it was a very clear and definite restatement of the American position. And so today, the Japanese ambassador handed to the Secretary of State a reply to that document turned over to them by Mr. Hull on November the 26th. Mr. Hull read that statement from the Japanese and immediately turned to the Japanese ambassador and with great indignation said, and we quote, I must say that in all my conversations with you, meaning the Japanese ambassador, during the last 9 months, I have never uttered one word of untruth. This is borne out absolutely by the record. In all my 50 years of public service, I have never seen a document that was more crowded with infamous falsehoods and distortions. Infamous falsehoods and distortions on a scale so huge that I never imagined until today that any government on this planet was capable of uttering them. Those are the words of Secretary of State Cordell Hull to the Japanese representatives, uttered this afternoon at, well, a few minutes after 2:20 o'clock here in Washington at the State Department. It was at that time, or around that time, the time that Nomura and Kurusu were at the State Department, that the first news was flashed in Washington of the attack on Pearl Harbor. And that news was flashed at the White House in the following statement. The Japanese have attacked Pearl Harbor from the air and all naval and military activities on the island of Oahu, the principal American base in the Hawaiian Islands. A second air attack is reported. This one has been made on Army and Navy bases in Manila. The President at the moment is meeting with Secretary of War Stimson, Secretary of the Navy, Knox, and Army Chief of Staff General Marshall. The President has called a meeting of the Cabinet for 8:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time tonight. The Cabinet meeting is to be followed by a meeting at the White House around 9 o'clock of the congressional leaders. This conference will include Vice President Wallace, Speaker of the House of Representatives Sam Rayburn, Chairman of the House Foreign Affairs Committee Saul Bloom, House Majority Leader John McCormick, House Minority Leader Joe Martin, and Representative Eaton of New Jersey. Senator Lister Hill, acting for Senator Barkley, Majority Leader of the Senate. Senator McNary, the Minority Leader. Senator Tom Connolly, Foreign Relations Committee of the Senate. And Senator Austin of the Military Affairs Committee. President Roosevelt has ordered the Army and the Navy to execute, and we quote, all previously prepared orders for defense immediately. And in that connection, we've been asked to announce on behalf of the War Department that all firms who are engaged in manufacturing for defense, any defense contracts, that all heads of those firms are urged to watch out for sabotage and be prepared. And now that sort of cleans up the news at the moment. We are keeping our eye on the White House and the State Department. And Fulton Lewis, Jr. has just walked into the studio, and I'm sure that he will have some news for you in just a few moments.
From the studios of WAAB in Boston, the Colonial Network presents Cedric Foster with his analysis of today's world events. Mr. Foster.
The United States of America, as never before in her history, tonight is mobilizing for war, and with her island possessions in the Far East bombarded by Japanese planes, with personnel of her Army, Navy, and Air Force already killed in action, fighting in which they had little opportunity to defend themselves, with two of her warships hard hit by Japanese high explosives, and one of them, the West Virginia, reported sunk. The might and strength of America was being rallied tonight, the length and breadth of the land. And as I speak to you now, the United States is at war. The formal declaration by Congress is merely a routine matter. It probably will take place tomorrow. President Roosevelt has been working tonight amidst reports of battle from the Far East, on the draft of his message to the Congress, one which without any question will call for a declaration of war tomorrow against the Nipponese Empire. And not only does the United States tonight mobilize for war against Japan, but in the offing there stands the threat of an open war declaration by Germany and Italy against the United States in view of the terms of the tripartite agreement which these two Axis countries signed with the Japanese a year ago. And this open declaration may or may not come, but it matters little, apparently, in the long run. As things now stand, the American people find themselves face to face with the task of fighting for their freedom and their liberty against all nations of the world who would deprive them of their rights as free men and women. And in this struggle, they're not going to be alone. Great Britain and her Commonwealth of Nations, her dominions throughout the world, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, South Africa will stand shoulder to shoulder in the Anglo-Saxon struggle to prevent world domination by the totalitarian powers. As a matter of fact, Canada already has declared war. Likewise will the Dutch East Indies wage war with Britain and America. The Netherlands government in the Far East will be at war with Japan as dawn breaks tomorrow. Costa Rica, the smallest of all the Latin American republics, already has announced herself at war with Japan. Washington advices tonight indicate that other Central or South American republics may follow suit. Russia may also come into the struggle. And orders are being flashed tonight throughout America to assemble the armed forces of the nation. Men have been ordered to report for duty. National Guardsmen have been summoned. Leaves and furloughs have been canceled. And in the state of California, which is teeming with Japanese nationals, extreme precautions have been taken to guard against any emergency. All aircraft warning stations were reported on the alert today and ordered to be so by Brigadier General Ryan of the 4th Interceptor Command in Los Angeles, who instructed the chief observers to see to it that posts are fully manned at all times. The military and civilian personnel of the 4th Air Force, the 4th Interceptor Command, and March Field were summoned to stations. In San Francisco, Mayor Angelo Rossi has declared a state of emergency in that Bay City, and he's asked all citizens to register at once for civilian defense at fire and police stations. The Civilian Defense Council of 60 businessmen were called into session. The Golden Gate and San Francisco Bay bridges were under heavy guard, as were all the utility properties in the city. Strategic highways in Northern California were cleared by the state police so that anti-aircraft batteries could be rushed to Vallejo. And Vallejo, of course, hard by as it is to San Francisco, is the site of the Mare Island Navy Yard. And in both Los Angeles and San Francisco, special police were patrolling the Japanese sections of these cities. There were no disorders reported, but the authorities were determined that they should hold the situation well in hand. But all along the Pacific coast, preparations for defense were evidenced on every hand. Army trucks and gun carriages were rumbling through the streets, out onto the highways from all of the key cities, from British Columbia to the Mexican border. And even in New York, Mayor LaGuardia took immediate steps to see to it that the Japanese population was under control. All Japanese citizens were ordered to stay at home until their status had been checked by the federal authorities. In the Canal Zone tonight, all the armed forces were on the alert. A blackout of this strategic defense lifeline of the United States was reported by radio. In Sacramento, California, that's the capital of the state, the city was placed in a state of emergency by City Manager James Dean. There are large numbers of Japanese residing in Sacramento, as well as in other Pacific Coast centers. And acting quickly in the emergency, the United States Navy has instituted complete censorship on all news to Hawaii and to the Far East. And this censorship concerned, however, only outgoing messages. It did not affect domestic news nor broadcasting. Voluntary censorship by radio stations and newspapers has been in effect in the United States for some time. In Washington, the Civil Aeronautics Authority banned the transportation of all Japanese nationals. And this order, incidentally, includes international as well as domestic American lines. And while all of this activity was going on, the President of the United States was in constant touch with members of his cabinet and with Army and Navy chieftains. And this afternoon, the President conferred at length with Secretary of Navy Frank Knox, Secretary of War Henry L. Stimson, and General George C. Marshall, General Marshall, who is Chief of the Army Staff. Admiral Harold R. Stark, who is the Chief of Naval Operations, remained at his desk in the United States Navy Department, and that was only to be expected in view of the naval action which has been involved in this crisis. And now that the first shock of the Japanese attack has been assimilated and absorbed, it's possible to analyze somewhat that which must have taken place before the Nipponese delivered their blows against the American Pacific outposts this morning. In the first place, the Japanese have no bases from which they could operate air attacks against Honolulu. Therefore, the assault must have originated from an aircraft carrier. And that means that the attack was carried out in complete premeditation days and days ago, all the while the Japanese envoys in Washington were talking with tongues in cheek about peace. And to the very last, the Japanese envoys continued this pretense of looking for peace when they knew beyond peradventure of doubt that the dies had been cast for war. And it was long after their planes had killed American defenders of Far Eastern posts that they sought an audience with Cordell Hull today to give to the Secretary of State Japan's answer to his note of the 26th of November. Well, Mr. Hull read that note very carefully. Then he turned to face the Mikado's representatives. And all of the righteous fury which had been pent up in that Tennessee statesman's heart burst on the heads of the Japanese representatives. And standing with a document in his hand, he spoke these words. "I must say that in all of my conversations with you," when he said that, he addressed Ambassador Admiral Kishisaburo Nomura, "I must say that in all of my conversations with you during the past 9 months, I have never uttered one word of untruth. This is borne out absolutely by the records. But in all of my 50 years of public service, I have never seen a document that was more crowded with infamous falsehoods and distortions on a scale so huge that I never imagined until today that any government on this planet was capable of uttering them." And with those words ringing in their ears, the Japanese plenipotentiaries hurriedly left the room. They answered monosyllabically the questions which were hurled at them by a room full of newspaper men. They donned their overcoats and they returned to the Japanese embassy. And later a large bonfire was observed in the rear yard of the building as Japanese documents went up in flames. Now, reports from the Far East tonight and from Hawaii indicate that the following events took place today. Honolulu was bombed shortly after dawn, with 50 to 100 planes participating in the attack. The assault was concentrated on Pearl Harbor, but bombs also were said to have fallen on the business section of the city. The number of dead so far reported in the military services totals 104, with more than 300 injured. There is no report on civilians killed, but deaths are known to have occurred. Attacks were made on Cavite, the United States naval base on the Philippine island of Luzon. Details are lacking. Manila was not reported as attacked. The United States island of Guam, 1,600 miles due west of the Philippines, was attacked. Details are lacking there. The United States island of Wake, 1,700 odd miles north and west of Guam, was said by Shanghai dispatches to have been occupied by the Japanese. The report said that no resistance was offered by the small American contingent located at this tiny outpost. The occupation has not been confirmed. There have been no reports of an attack on Midway Island, which is about 3,000 miles north and west of Guam, and about 1,400 miles north and east of Honolulu. A later attack on Honolulu was reported by Governor Poindexter to President Roosevelt by direct telephonic conversation. The governor said that the attack was underway as he was speaking to the president. And from the Far East, it was reported that the Japanese have occupied the international settlement at Shanghai. They've sunk a British gunboat and taken over the city. Reports also have been received that the Japanese have invaded Thailand. From Singapore comes news that the Japanese have attempted to land troops on the coast of Singapore, but they were repulsed by small arms fire and by action of British aeroplanes. This is an official communique from the British Eastern High Command. In the Philippines tonight, President Quezon declared, "The zero hour is here. Every man and woman must be at his or her post to do the duty assigned. Until responsible authorities order otherwise, people must attend to daily affairs as usual. The main thing to do is to be calm and to have faith. And let us place our confidence in God, who has never forsaken our people." And Lieutenant General MacArthur, Douglas MacArthur, announced that the Philippines were on a complete war footing and that he ordered the evacuation of women and children from Manila to the hinterland of the island. Manila also has a report that a United States transport was sunk with a loss of 350 lives, 1,600 miles east of Manila. There was no confirmation of that report. On the military and naval side of the ledger in the war with Japan so far, The USS West Virginia was said to have been sunk. The USS Oklahoma reported set afire by the attack on Pearl Harbor. Heavy damage was done to the Army Air Base at Hickman Field. There's no confirmation as yet on the two battleships reported struck by the Japanese. Off the coast of Oahu, a Japanese aircraft carrier was reported sunk. Another such vessel, flying the flag of the rising sun, was said to have been sunk off Latin America. Tonight at the White House, President Roosevelt met with cabinet members as well as congressional leaders. Among those at the conference were Representative Jerry Cooper of Tennessee, acting majority leader of the House, Senator McNary of Oregon, Senator Hiram Johnson, Saul Bloom, Speaker Raven, and Senator Tom Connolly of Texas, Representative Joe Martin of Massachusetts, and Senator Leader Barkley of Kentucky. Just prior to coming into the studios, the news was flashed from Singapore that Japanese troops have succeeded in landing on northern Malaya, north of the Singapore base. Violent fighting has taken place. At the same time, General MacArthur informed the White House that Japanese planes were over the central part of the island of Luzon. A bombing attack was made at Davao on the southern end of the island of Mindanao. And another attack has been made at Camp John Hayes in the northern mountains of Luzon. And this attack was reported while the cabinet was still in session. And here in America tonight, I don't know of any better way to state the sentiment of the nation than to quote Senator Wheeler. In view of the fact that Japan has made a vicious attack on the United States, there's only one thing to do, and that is for Congress to immediately declare war. I had sincerely hoped to avoid war. I've campaigned against it, but now we must go to war, and everyone's job is to join hands and back up the president and the army and the navy.
Cedric Foster has presented his analysis of today's world events from the studios of WAAB in Boston, key station of the Colonial Network in New England. Mr. Foster is heard over most of these stations each week, Monday through Friday at 2 p.m. and Saturdays at 10 p.m. This is the Mutual Broadcasting System.